Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. Thank you again for your responses to the questions and the communication by email. I appreciate your responses. It helps give me an idea of what is of particular interest and application to you. One of the things that I'm going to address first is to give illustrations. I mentioned our first seminar was really an overview of the contributions to coaching, and we're going to begin to apply that. We're going to talk about mastery, states of mind, and mentalization today, and the use of some case studies from some of the responses and questions you have. I'll incorporate a couple of case studies today and keep that in mind about more client illustrations and that sort of thing of some of the principles we'll talk about. So we're going to look at an application beginning today with states of mind, which I think is an important first step, and we'll talk about why that's important. And again, I'll keep an open mic at the beginning and the end of our seminar for any input or questions or clarification. So anybody want to check in or say hi or add a question or a comment to anything that we've either talked about or a follow-up in terms of the responses that you sent? Well, let me begin with an open mic, because I'm interested in your response, and I promise I'll stick to our schedule and get with it in a minute. But a couple of the questions really centered around a way to get clients to engage in a co-creative relationship and to make a transition from information, data, facts, opinions, that sort of thing, and then how to engage individuals and groups with this. So the very simplest way that I can say that, and we'll elaborate, and it will make more sense to you in terms of application of neuroscience, but what we know from, for example, conversational intelligence, the first few words that we use boots up a particular mindset for someone, a listener or reader, to respond to. If that mindset is the beginning of a collaborative framework and a connection in some way, it boots up a whole neurochemical system mediated by oxytocin, the chemical of bonding and connection. If someone perceives it as judgmental or critical or pejorative, then it boots up a mindset that is kind of protective and cautious. So from the very beginning, we have a way to think about engaging and creating a mindset. Now, what we do in coaching, first question we ask often is, what do you want to focus on for today? What would be most helpful to focus on? Same question I ask you about the seminar series. So the client determines the agenda. The coordinates then are determined collaboratively. The coordinates of the map, where someone is, where they want to go, and that's what you collaboratively determine. So what's the antithesis of information, training, various kinds of opinions, facts, suggestions from the coach? The antithesis is a question. Because when you give an opinion, and both coach and client want you to give an opinion, a suggestion, even disguise a suggestion in the form of a question, well, have you thought about, because that brings closure. Neither of you have to engage further with the uncertainty of not knowing exactly. You don't have to deal with cognitive dissonance because there's a closure. Now, never mind that the client is not going to most likely follow through on it, even though you know it's the best thing. Here's what happens, mind and brain level. You have a belief, and you share that belief or you share that advice with a client. Now, a belief, a fact, is an anatomical reality in the client's brain. And the client will immediately begin to compare what they see or think or feel or know with what you said. If they agree, they're going to seek ways to confirm it, confirmation bias. If they don't like it, if they don't agree with it, they'll seek ways to refute it. So here's the result that we know now from neuroscience. That's the boomerang effect. Whatever someone believes already or knows, they're going to be more entrenched than they were before. So what the coach or anyone else is trying to do will be to further entrench that person in the person's already existing opinion. So that's what happens, that we try to avoid in giving facts, opinions, suggestions to a client, but really began a framework of collaboration, of looking together at something new, and then framing it so the client can explore in a self-reflective way. So, and we know we commit to what we co-create, so the client is establishing the agenda. So at a mind and brain level, this is the beginning of a different kind of communication than giving a fact or opinion or data. And if somebody has Google, they already have enough fact and opinion and information. So they certainly don't need it from us. Any thoughts or follow-up for that? I'll promise to move into our topic, but I wanted to just address that because I had some really good comments and questions about that in response to my initial email. Anything you want to add or ask? Well, I'll move into our discussion. Again, it's going to roughly follow the outline, but I want to incorporate some of the things that you guys have suggested, and especially they add a couple of case studies. So I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. But if you have questions or thoughts or clarifications, jot them down, and we'll come to them at the end of the seminar. Okay, we're going to talk about mastery of states of mind and look at mentalization just a bit. So I want to discuss what I think is the most important variable to determine success for professionals: the mastery and regulation of states of mind. A couple of studies, Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review, found that the most successful executives shared among all the possibilities of training, education, degrees, various kinds of experience, the one thing that most correlated with success was the self-awareness and self-regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. Now, I think that's the case simply because that's who they studied, is executives. I think that's the case with everyone. I think that will be the case with every client you experience. So let's look first at understanding states of mind. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state. It's a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and how we process information and then how we respond. So each state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns. So a key element in mentor coaching is to help a client become aware of these various states of mind, if that's an issue for the client, with particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. So here's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. And I'll ask you to bear with me from this. You may remember it from a college course. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you teach the rat to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you make another rat, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine and then teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you, with that rat, with the injected amphetamine, just a little bit, simulating a stress condition. It can't get to the cheese when you take away the amphetamine. The state is different. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, because even though it's in a portion of its brain about how to get to the cheese, it can't access it. Now, you re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. This is very much, it's kind of an extreme and a goofy example, but it's about state-specific learning and state-dependent memory in that example. That's very much like our minds work. Think about a common example. You try to remember somebody's name, you can't. It's like it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't quite get it. You go through, if you're me, go through the alphabet. That may not make it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind, boom, the name comes easily. This is different states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. Again, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. Each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what kind of endeavor. Even we may be aware of how to enter and exit different states. It's very important to become aware of what state to engage, for example, for a creative endeavor, for what state to enter for conceptual planning. Various states of mind have very specific functions. I want to give you an example of something that I think vividly illustrates how important these are and how important it is to understand our state, the state of mind of our clients. So first, let's look at what comes first. First, regulate your state of mind before you engage with a client. Get grounded and centered. From that state, you have access to all the information in all of your states of mind. If a client begins a session with indicating that there's something that has them skewed a bit, you know, I've just been so overwhelmed, or I've been so frustrated, I think it's important to resonate with that, to let the client know you get it, and then look at proceeding from that position, such as, you know, I hear you're overwhelmed, or I hear the frustration. Let's focus on what would be helpful to give you some traction with that. So here's an example. I'll explain the system in the case. So let me just start there. I'll call her Barbara. She paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions when we were focusing on her executive leadership strategy. She was doing a terrific job, outstanding leader, to mention that she was about to be distracted over, at that time, the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays. She indicated with a good deal of embarrassment that each time she goes home to her family, she has the same problem. She spends one major holiday a year with her family, and this particular year it was Thanksgiving. She said, "We have a big gathering where my parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days once a year. I resolve before I go that this time is going to be different, that I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and fights with my brother and sister." This was a very high-functioning executive woman, just, you know, right at 50 years old. "I can usually last most of the first day, and then something happens, and I just lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family, then escalates to a fight with everybody, and the rest of the weekend is just shattered every time. Is there anything you can do to help me with this?" And my response, "I hear how frustrating it is when you want an enjoyable holiday with your family and to connect, and this recurs." And she wholeheartedly agreed. And I asked, "When you're in the middle of that upset and arguing with them, What's the age of that conversation for you? She did not need any explanation. She didn't need to think. She said immediately, early adolescence. I'm 13 instantly and totally at that time. And I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. I asked her what she was aware of that specifically triggered her reactions. She described first a particular look from her dad and how that would set her off. And she elaborated. And then a particular word from her mom, a gesture from her brother that would immediately provoke her to feel angry. She was very aware of this process. Her reactive state of mind instantly transported her to that early adolescent time capsule. I suggested that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself and to reflect on the following. One, just as she had begun to do, list each specific emotional trigger with every family member. Everything that was an emotional trigger, that word from her mom, the look from her dad, the gesture with her brother that she felt angry, each trigger, and put that, actually I didn't know to do this at the time, but what I did subsequently, draw three lines vertically on a page so that there are four columns. This is column one, each specific emotional trigger. And the second column, alongside that emotional trigger, what is the reaction to that specific trigger? A thought, a feeling, a behavior, negative self-talk. And then I suggested, and that she do it without triggering herself, without getting into it, but looking at it, observing it, self-reflecting, and being aware, as she had already begun to do. She had worked hard on this. She just didn't quite have a system yet. So I suggested that she do this and then set it aside maybe for 24 hours and then schedule another appointment with herself where she could, again, get present and really focus on this process. And for column three, to create a three-step process to get centered and present for each emotional trigger. A mantra, a cue, a focus, and a physiology. And I'll go over where this originated in another example. But a cue to initiate or just remind her to really get grounded and centered. And she knew about mindfulness meditation. She used breathing. She knew how to do this. She just needed a specific way to do it in an instance like this. So her cue was she decided she would touch her ring. That was the gesture. Coupled with a focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain, and hers was relaxed and powerful. And then a physiology, like a deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out any tension. So this mantra, this cue, focus, physiology, would take 2 to 3 seconds. And I suggested that she practice it several times before she left for the holiday with her family so that she would have it already partly at least in place where maybe just touching the ring would remind her and even evoke that relaxed state. And then this second brainstorming session with herself in column four, that she have an ideal response to each of the emotional triggers. What ideally would she like to do or how would she ideally like to behave in response to that so that it's pre-planned? So that across now, she has a cue such as something from some family member triggers her, she recognizes it a bit more quickly and objectively so that she doesn't get lost in it because that cue triggers a state change. And the state change, the content of column two, It's a time capsule. It's not changed. It's the same negative self-talk, the same, you experience it all over again. So in recognizing this process, she could begin more quickly and readily move to self-regulate. She would touch her ring, do the breath and the focus phrase, and then have an ideal behavior plan. Simple, specific, but planned. And I suggested that, I did suggest, I was not getting certification from ICF, and they weren't recording this. So I suggested that not only that she practice this process, but also that she could call a timeout at any point. She did not have to react even when she felt triggered. She could get up, walk away. She had any number of timeouts. This wasn't the NBA where you have a limit. Or she could simply get up and move from the table to the bathroom or take a walk. So she worked on this. And this was a proactive regulation of state of mind and a new game plan. So she sent me the initial draft of her four columns. I just reiterated then, I emphasized that the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to quickly recognize the emotional trigger that was state-changing otherwise and the resultant state change to her age 13 time capsule, the column two thoughts, feelings, behaviors. Then to use her mantra, column three, to get grounded and centered to engage an ideal pre-planned response, column four, for each emotional trigger. And she really worked on this. This was like a week and a half before Thanksgiving. She really worked on it. In our first session, after the Thanksgiving holiday, she began by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times that were challenging. I mean, after all, it was still her family, she reminded me. But even times when she would excuse herself or go for a walk or go to the next room to get grounded and centered where just touching her ring was not quite enough at that time, it created the response she wanted. She was very pleased with her work, as I was for her, and she recognized that this was a system that she was going to work on further, and we later applied it to her executive presence and executive functioning, and particularly to a person in her corporation that was emotionally triggering, so that right before she opened the door to go in to meet with this person, she would touch her ring, get grounded and centered, and that framed what could then be a co-created experience with someone in a better way. And Barbara's final response for that first session after, she said, you know, that was incredible, but it was really hard work. And I said, I understand how hard and how successfully you work. The only thing harder, as you already knew, was not doing it. And she totally agreed with that. So that's just one microsystem of regulating states of mind and managing emotion in order to be more effective in doing that. So let's look a little bit more at accessing mind states. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involves understanding and mastery of access to a particular state of mind, or especially, as in Barbara's case, to get grounded and centered and use that as a foundation. Now, this is, you know, we refer to this as staying present. Let me give you some examples, because probably nowhere is this more poignant than the regulation of states of mind for artists and writers, because they have to create a way to enter that space that's creative. Here are some examples. Damita Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Bo Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite authors, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank suspended across a warm bubble bath to get their flowing thoughts. The painter Turner liked to be lashed on the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could later recreate this experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repeatedly during the course of writing to create an emotional framework that sort of houses their evolving story. Look at how much simpler it is to touch your ring or do some gesture or some cue or even just focused phrase. So the corresponding state of mind of the reader often matches with the author or the viewer with the artist, in which, for example, the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. The most natural method of regulating state change is distraction, attention and focus. For example, the crying infant who cannot be calmed, the jangle car keys. So we each have our own ways, if you think about it, and can even develop it further, to immediately focus and engage selective attention, like getting grounded in a physical activity, a walk outdoors, a warm bath, breathing exercises. So we're going to discuss a little bit more about how to do this with clients in just a moment. So it's important for us as a mentor coach to enter into and really resonate with the mind-body state of the client to understand the subjective experience as well as the story and the content that the client communicates and co-creates with you. This works, as I know it to be, as well by telephone as it does video conference and in person. And I've done all of those. And there is a kind of freedom that you don't get visually distracted with in person and video by telephone. I do all of my mentor coaching clients by telephone. So developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. So most of the interactions in a relationship may be outside conscious awareness. In a right brain to right brain communication, I'm overly simplifying here, of emotional state of coach and client. We get intuitive blinks. We need to remain grounded and centered and open to communication to resonate with the client's experience that I believe precedes any kind of synthesizing and planning with the client and continues throughout. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. We can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, plan. So we need to keep this right brain engagement, this grounding and centering, to be able to have that resonance. Now, here's where the coaching experience, in my view, is analogous to mindfulness meditation. If you use focusing on breathing as a way to meditate, you focus on your breath, the breathing in relaxation, breathing out tension. If your brain has a thought, as it will, because that's its job description, to activate you instead of all this relaxation stuff. You think about something you didn't do, you think, boom, let it go and refocus on your breath. Whatever comes up, you stay focused on your breath, refocus on your breath. Same with the client. You're attuned to the client and the experience with the client. If you stop that for even a second to think about, am I asking the right question? Or to wonder if you should make a suggestion. do what you do with your breath, refocus, let it go, and refocus on your client. This is the art and science of mentor coaching, to create and sustain that collaborative framework. So here's an everyday application to recognize and understand emotional couplings. No matter how logical we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, then to the hippocampus, still in the midbrain, that attaches meaning, then to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to make logical sense. Now, a footnote here. The hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious where meanings are attached. And unconscious is a term, remember, from at least psychoanalysis and other places. Everything in the midbrain is an unconscious process. So notice also the emotional activation registers before the cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options or create closure by saying, well, this is the reason. Neuroscientists demonstrate that we make decisions. For example, one neuroeconomics lab that I communicate or collaborate with, they have done studies to show that we make purchase decisions to buy something up to 10 seconds before we're consciously aware that we do it. This same lab shows that if you hook 10 people up, for example, to an fMRI and show them objects, and their task is to purchase one, they can predict over 90% of the time which one of the objects shown will be the one that the person buys, because when they look at that particular object, each person, it activates the part of the brain that has more to do with the sense of self, of identity. We purchase, we engage what we identify with. You know, we'll come back to that, but that's just an example of the predictability. So once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or no, then we're going to the left prefrontal cortex, especially, is on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision, the confirmation bias. So when we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experience with the best guesses of a likely future. So here's where, for example, that people who maybe in marketing, for example, know how to address this. For example, credit cards decouple buying, activation of the pleasure center, and paying, activation of the pain center in the brain. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented then from the pain of future payment, of giving up something that's yours, your money. This segmentation renders payment actually, as a future abstraction. So this means practically that when people use a credit card instead of cash or write a check, they spend 23% more when this decoupling occurs. So another application, it's hard to save for the future because the way our minds and brains are wired, work and wire. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying because just the anticipation of a purchase triggers dopamine, the pleasure chemical. So spending money, activating the pleasure center, but paying then makes it hard, for example, to substitute a future theory like a future need, long-term saving, retirement, for the immediate. So let's look at ways to regulate states of mind. The most important thing I think we can do to achieve success is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. So think about what these people have in common. John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain, they did not learn or sustain the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind, using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus, anything you that you view, see, or think about. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. So the state of mind determines behavior, so by changing the state of mind, we change the behavior. Think about what we talked about in terms of the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology. There are two primary ways to regulate a state of mind, physiology and focus. The cue is simply to remind you to do it. The physiology, how you use your body to change your body, your biochemistry, relaxation, deep breathing, meditation, focus, what and how we focus on. From quantum physics and brain science, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain. We pay attention to what we focus on. That can determine a state of mind. Your state of mind determines then the meaning you attach. So two questions that we usually look at in some way, not maybe consciously, but what does this mean? What should I do? And that's determined by what we focus on. So here's something that we can think about to ask a better question. And that's focusing on the part we get what we focus on. If we focus on something negative, we'll bring it about. If we focus on something positive, we're set to bring that about. So what will you create today that will be more powerful than you had previously imagined, and have fun at doing it? So your brain follows your focus. So asking more effective questions can determine your state of mind. This is your power of focus. Right before opening the door, remember, Barbara would do her cue and a deep breath and a focused phrase. Initially, doing this each time, after that, only touching her ring was simply enough. That's the neuroassociative conditioning of that chart, the four columns, that if you go across from the usual trigger to an ideal behavior, if you do that enough, it will rewire your brain. And ultimately, simply the cue will immediately create that state change that previously needed even a focus on relaxation and focus to do. It can be instantaneous. So this is part of the power of the mind and brain, but it's also of developing a system, a microsystem like that neuroconditioning that we talked about using Barbara's situation, and looking, we'll be talking about other perspectives of creating a system, because if you want to change, don't just focus on the goal. Most people have similar goals. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system, and that's what we're developing now. So the best leaders, mentors, teachers, coaches are the ones who ask the best questions. That's the antithesis of giving facts, information, data, and having somebody compare what they believe, whether it's conscious or not. So ask a better question. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community? third place between home and work. Now, listen to how Steve Jobs, back in the day, convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at Apple. When they were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, Jobs simply asked Sculley, "You want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world?" So here's an exercise. I'd suggest you write down just the idea of the exercise and come back to it after we're done, or better yet, before you can go to sleep tonight. Write down three questions that, when you answer them, will put you in a peak state. First thing when you wake up in the morning, answer each of these three empowering questions and feel the answer. See what that does to initiate your day. Remember, we're always asking questions, even before we're fully awake, maybe even before we're fully aware. This just changes the focus to consciously engineer questions that can empower you. So here's an example of the mantra and self-regulation. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. They're the lowest in the division of 217. So during practice, he had each of his players develop a mantra before each free shot, a focus, a cue, which was to dribble the ball, a focus phrase, which he suggested relaxed and smooth, but that they each come to their own, and then a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension, and to do that before each shot. And so in the 3 or 4 seconds that they would dribble and do the focus phrase, the relaxation before each shot, and then additionally, he had them to engage in a free shot when he would suddenly blow the whistle, because in a game, you're fouled, you're in an altered state. So he had them suddenly go to the free shot line. If they made it, they got a break. If they didn't, they did laps. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. They were very effective in this process. So here are how we associate things. What you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. So this is neural association. So there are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain, to move away, to prevent pain, and the desire to gain pleasure, to move toward, to gain. These are biological forces. So these forces of pain and pleasure are biological, and they're implemented by our mind and brain, so it may help to know these. To gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal or business decision. Examples of gain: promotion to make more money, to help others, improve our lives, get what you desire. Examples of preventing pain: to avoid change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something you're afraid of. So this is something to consider if you're not doing something that you want or need to do, then you may link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere you may link greater pain to having money, or at least to change. So this may be a shadow story. Well, all this effort, and I think I'm just comfortable where I am. I'd really be embarrassed if I gave it my all and then I failed. Or, you know, people are going to judge me. I'll be ostracized. There's some shadow story that has to do with avoiding pain. So it's not necessarily self-sabotage. It's just understanding these two forces. So here are coaching questions about these two biological forces. What's the greater pain if you don't do it? And what's the greater pleasure if you do do it? So we take these and convert them into questions for someone to consider what's next. So we're defined by the stories we tell ourselves. So we want to be able to self-reflect, to be self-aware, and to look at how we write our own stories and how then we can collaboratively co-create a new story with a client. So this is what we do in each session with a client. A coaching session is a collaborative engagement to create a coaching story. The story is not a slice of life. And those of you who did my last series with me, Breaking the Script, we talked about this in some length because this is one of our specialties as coaches, is to break the script, because we all want to continue with doing the same thing, the default mode. Our mind and brain resist change, as we discussed a bit last time. So this is something that we engage in a collaborative way with the client to look at creating a system. And this first system is the coaching story, the focus and the destination. Those are the two coordinates of the map that we co-create with a client. That's a mini system in and of itself. The client determines the focus, the client determines the destination, and we collaboratively proceed to successively approximate that in the coaching story. And every coaching story, every coaching session has the same three components of any story, whether it's a novel or a blog: the challenge, the development, the resolution. The two coordinates. What do you want to focus on? Where do you want to get to? The summary, the takeaway that's most important. That puts it in an output channel for the client. Here's the simplest study. Many of you have heard this from me before. I love simple studies. University of Waterloo did a study, a large number of volunteers. They all read the same passage in a book, half read it out loud, half read it silently. The ones who, and everybody was given a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. So this is a component of creating a system. And the coaching story is a system with the conclusion of what are you taking away and then what do you commit to, so that it concretizes it for the client to create a system to proceed. And they have their own system. While we're talking about this, they're downloading the model that we use. So when suddenly you're nowhere on the horizon, they have a model of, well, there are three or four things going on. Well, pick one. And then where do I want to get to with this? That's a map. And then that map, internalized over time, means that we have achieved our goal, that we have helped the client grow and succeed beyond what they may have imagined, and they no longer need us. So that's especially useful. Let me give you an example of an application for this in a somewhat different way. This is an example of an application of doing something systematically, as we're just talking about now, of a focus as an initial way of regulating states of mind and creating a systematic way to sustain that focus and that state of mind. So as we're talking about it here, it's like a state of mind is useful because it contains the software. A simple example, you know, if you're in a creative state of mind and write something, you don't want to mix it or cross over with a different state of mind that's editing. So pick your spot, stay with it. Here's an example of someone I'm going to call Seth. He was a successful CPA with his own accounting firm. He was functioning brilliantly when he was concentrating on a specific task. Now, much of his day, for 3 to 5 hours, he would be focusing on a task, and he was really good at it, except his focus would get derailed by numerous distractions during the day, like telephone calls, curbside consults from his associates. Each time he was interrupted, he disengaged from his task to give his full attention to the issue presented, the curbside consult, the call, the text. Then he returned to address his project. His goal was that he wanted to function more effectively, ultimately move his accounting firm to a regional, and dare he would hope it, a national presence. So what we looked at, each of these tasks required a different mindset with focused attention, and each transition required cognitive energy to navigate the state changes. He recognized how disruptive and impractical this process was for his energy and effectiveness. He had even wondered if he had attention deficit disorder. So we collaborated on a simple structure to focus without interruption on each task that required a particular mindset. For example, he decided to concentrate his best creative time, the first 2 hours of each business day, on his business plan to expand to that regional firm. He then planned specific times during the day to consult with his associates for their questions. He had his associate cluster those curbside consults into one particular hour, his telephone calls into one particular time segment. Same with his text, same with everything that required a different state of mind. You know, it's been said that it takes as much energy to change a state of mind and get back as it does to run a TV, in that analogy of energy, for 5 hours. So each time he was interrupted, he went from being immersed to refocus on the person or the thing that he was attending to, and then to get back to his state of concentration and focus. So it was kind of triple work. So he established daily and weekly schedules so we would have a map for each day as well as the week. And he decided to place his daily map on a post-it note on the left of his computer screen. He then put each task for each hour on the right of his screen with regular replacement each hour. This weekly and daily and hourly schedule helped him stay oriented and focused and give his full measure of attention to each task, meaning that he was fully immersed when he did the curbside consults as well as he was in his creative planning. He enjoyed a greater effectiveness and more fun each day and developed a very successful regional firm. So this was simply an example of applying a system that took into account how he wanted to create his structure and to do it in the way that he could determine better, way better than I could have, how he would do that in a structured way. So I want to allow a response or questions to anything that I've mentioned. You'll see on the outline, there's probably more that I could talk about, but I really would like to get any thoughts or responses that you have, and to look at what would be most helpful for you for us to discuss. So just to summarize, notice in the case of Seth, it wasn't the goal he focused on, but it was the next step in the system. And this is what being focused, being grounded and centered allows a sustained state of immersion and sustaining a state of mind to really fit the task and to adapt and to create a systematic way of addressing and proceeding. So this is, I think, an important aspect of what we may do in working with clients. So I'm going to go to, I have another case I can just mention briefly, but I'm really more interested in any thoughts or questions that you have. So hold on. Okay, we're in discussion mode. Any thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to discuss a bit more? Well, let me give you one. Interrupt me at any time. Let me illustrate with one other case. I'm going to call this guy Nathan. Nathan was a well-known nonfiction writer. He was just off a New York Times bestseller, but he was experiencing what he called a writer's block. He hadn't produced anything for like 6 months, 6 weeks rather, when he called me. And this is his livelihood. He was excited, but somehow he didn't know what to do next. So I asked him to go through his writing we began mentor coaching on this. I asked him to walk me through, step by step, his writing process in detail to describe what he did and what he was experiencing. And I also asked to hear his internal dialogue. If he would talk to himself, I wanted to be privy to that conversation. So he described how, as he sat down to write, he said, you know, I get nervous, and I began doing a lot of different things than writing. And then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller or if it was just a one-off, a one-time happening. So we explored the details of this process and how these questions stopped him and how he was distracted. And it felt a bit different to me. I asked him this, and this was kind of an intuitive guess. I said, I'd like to share a hunch with you and see if it might be helpful for us to look at. It sounds like you might be getting really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience. And he said, yeah, that's exactly true. And we talked about that, and I said, it sounds like you may be reading the excitement as anxiety. And that puts you in your old story where anxiety equals danger or I'm not going to make it, possibly. And in that story, distracting yourself was adaptive. It was a way of regulating the tension. And we did this not all in that paragraph that I said, but that was a back and forth process. But he recognized exactly what he was doing as he did in an earlier time when he registered the excitement as anxiety, and then he would distract himself. That was adaptive at an earlier time. So this is an example of how we touched on this in our initial seminar, how our brains register excitement and anxiety in exactly the same way, the same activation process, the same area. How we frame it can make a major difference of the mindset we use to look at what's next. We boot up a mindset of that's anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, or we boot up a mindset of excitement, of possibility of what's next. Very different mindsets, very different ways of proceeding. So we looked at how he could then frame this excitement in a way to use it to do what he wanted to do. He reframed it as a validation of being in that new experience, as a signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. The result, he produced an even bigger bestseller. This was simply a matter of framework and understanding, developing that self-awareness, the regulation of states of mind, but also framing it in a way that allowed him to fully engage it and to use the full passion and excitement as a way of engaging it. So he correctly identified the excitement. I know we're out of time, but I want to tell you one other story, because I think you'll see this in your coaching work, how we can misattribute emotion. Someone I collaborate, a neuroscientist who is an avid mountain climber, was about to climb a peak in Australia. And he was so excited. He'd been planning and working for this for some time. And he was paired, as they were in the base camp, with a woman who had similar skill and expertise. And he was excited. She was excited as they were beginning. And he thought, and this is his story, he thought that this is the love of my life. This is what I've been looking for all this time. He was so excited, and they had a terrific time together. And he recognized soon after the climb and in the aftermath that the excitement he had misattributed. He thought the excitement meant he was in love with her and that this was the one. And he realized the excitement of the climb he had misattributed to the person. There are a number of studies about this, not about him, but this is an example of how we can misattribute emotion. A simple example. We take a step into the new, the unknown, the different. Every step our brain registers as some kind of discomfort or a disruption. If we attribute that, for example, to being an imposter, that I can't really do that, that's a misattribution. But it can bring closure instead of recognizing this is the brain's recognition that this is new and different. If you frame it as excitement, as Nathan came to do, you're in business. So anything we didn't cover, anything you want to talk about, ask about, fire off an email. I hope this has been useful, helpful. I'm eager to hear any feedback or any takeaways that you have. Write down your most important takeaway. I didn't allow enough time for it. I'm going to have to respect the time. Actually, we're over. But anything you want to communicate in email, let me know. Look forward to picking up right here next time. Thank you very much. See you now.